coming up on this episode of Embracing Change with Lakrita Bowman and Jennifer Osborne.
I felt like I was about 8 steps away from a reality that I didn't know whether or not I was really ready for.
Today, we are going to be talking about a very profound, deep subject related to Chapter 8 of Lakrita's book, Breaking the Cycle of Self-Abuse. And in that speaks to the moment you met your birth mother and how that kind of changed a lot of your identity and thoughts about who she was and who you were. So we're going to just jump right into that. So in your book, it was 1997. Mm-hmm. And you had went to a family reunion, it was?
Yeah, my foster mom, the mom who actually raised me, Evelyn is my biological mom, and Mary Helen is my foster mom. And so the only family I knew was Mary Helen's family. And so I went to Louisville, Kentucky for a family reunion. And this was like the first time in a while that I actually went. And my sister, which is also a foster child, her name is Linda, we were all together. We drove together. It was like we rented a van and we all went together. And that was kind of the first time that had ever really happened. I'm now knowing that it wasn't by coincidence. Mm. So.
Yeah, God doesn't do anything by accident.
My sister, Linda, realized that the park we were having the family reunion at was across the street from Miss Bernice's house.
Oh, wow.
And out of nowhere, my sister said, we were sitting there at the bench, and she said, I think Miss Bernice lives like right across the street from here. And then I said, who is Miss Bernice? And she's like, she's one of Mama's best friends. When we lived in Louisville and we used to come and visit, we used to always go visit Miss Bernice. And I said, oh, okay. I said, how does Miss Bernice fit into the whole picture? And she's mm-hmm. like, Miss Bernice, Mama, they worked together at this dry cleaners and they were all friends. And every Friday night they would get together and they would go get drinks and they would go to bingo. And she was just kind of giving me that information that honestly, because you got to realize that me and my foster sister that grew up in the same house was not that close because she is 70, I'm going to be 60, so she's 10 years older than I am. But we also got to realize that I was always in and out of the house because I was in and out of girls' school, in and out of institutions. So, and then when she got 18, she graduated from high school. And then when she graduated a couple of years later, she married and had her first child. So I wasn't really that close to her, and we wasn't that connected. And so this was like a phenomenal moment. So she was kind of updating me about Miss Bernice. So I said, well, do you know where she lives? And she's like, yeah, I think she lives in had one house. It was like, she said, she lives in one of these three houses. And even if she doesn't live there now, she used to. And she just said, I feel like I want to go over there. You want to go with me? And I was like, I guess. Yeah, I'll go. And so when we went to the house, it was so amazing because soon as she knocked on first door, she thought that was the house. It was Miss Bernice's house. And Miss Bernice came to the door, and my sister was in front, and she's like, hey, Miss Bernice, you remember me? I'm Linda, Mary Holland's daughter. And Miss Bernice, you know, from the South, I being from the South, I think you're from the South as well, you know, they don't meet strangers, and, you know, it's something about the South people. And she's like, girl, get on in here. You know, get on in here, girl. She's like, oh, my God. Give me a hug. And so I'm just kind of following suit. I'm just coming in. And so I come into the house and she's like, have a seat. What are y'all doing here? And then my sister told her, we're across the street. We're having a family reunion. You know, all Mama's sisters is over there. Her brothers is over there. So Miss Bernice said, oh, let me get something together. I'm going to come over there too. And so by this time she said, Miss Bernice said, is this Pinky? Because they call me Pinky. As I was growing up, my sister's name was Poochie. Our real names were Lucretia and Linda, but they called us Pinky. It was our nicknames. And my sister said, yeah, this is Pinky. And Miss Bernice said, oh my God, I ain't seen you since you was about 4.
Wow.
You know, so in 1997 of August, I was 36. So she hadn't seen me for 32 years.
Wow.
And so then she looked at me and she said, girl, she said, when's the last time you seen your mama? And I looked at Miss Bernice like she had lost her mind.
Because you're thinking of your foster mom.
Exactly. Yeah. And I know Miss Bernice know mama was dead. So I'm like, why is she asking me that? And so I said, what are you talking about? I said, you know, mama died in 1989. She said, girl, I ain't talking about Mary Helen. I'm talking about Evelyn.
Hmm.
And I said, I don't even know who you're talking about. And she's like, oh, I'm talking about your mama who had you. She said, we used to all work together. And she just got to talking like I knew that. It was so, when I look back at it, it was so unnatural. But it was, again, a word that God's been giving me lately about catapulting me into situations. I felt like I was catapulted into a moment. But I have to take you back. This was August. And I have to take you back to April of that same year. I was in worship. And as I was in worship, I had, you know, I got familiar with the Spirit of the Lord and the Holy Spirit and how He speaks to our hearts. And I now knew by this time, you know, I'd been out of prison 5 years. I knew that the voice that spoke to me in prison was really the Spirit of the Lord speaking to Himself in me. And so I was having an encounter in April in worship service. And I heard this still small voice say to me, I'm going to change your name. I'm going to change your name. As I change your identity, I'm going to change your name. And I just wept.
Wow.
Because for me, that meant so much because of everything I'd been through. And so I just kind of moved on. And then so coming back to August, Miss Bernice being in this moment was like a catapulting moment. And so I said to Miss Bernice, no, I've never met Evelyn. So no, I haven't seen her. I don't know where she is. And she's like, girl, your grandfather, he just lived like three or four blocks down the street. Do you want to go meet him? And I was like, I'm not really sure if I want to do all that, Miss Bernice. She's like, girl, look, you should go meet him. And so Miss Bernice got dressed and we went over into the park. And of course, she stayed for a little while. And then she said it again. She said, girl, you ready to go? Because, girl, we can just go right on down the street. And I'm telling you, I know exactly where you live at. And I was like, I don't know. So Charles was there. My son, DeLorean, was there. And my sister was there. And I said to my sister, I said, you think I should do it? She's like, what is it going to hurt? She said, worst scenario, it won't let nothing to happen. Or best scenario, you'll meet your family. And I was like, okay, I'll do it. So me and Miss Bernice got the van that we had rented to come up there, and it was just she and I.
You had said in the book, though, that when Miss Bernice had actually proposed this to you to go and meet your birth mother, that you were not prepared for that decision because you figured in your head somewhere you would eventually meet her on your terms.
In my way.
When you were ready. And so here this huge moment is just thrust upon you and you have to make a split second.
Like right in that moment, I got to make a decision. Or I could have not, really. You know, really, I could have not made a decision. You know, when I look at that now, years later, I did have the power to choose not to. But for some reason, again, I keep saying I don't really believe I had a lot of control in that moment. As much as I have been a control freak. And I don't believe it was a moment that I had control over, that it was something bigger than me that was happening.
That was pushing past what would have been resistance.
Exactly.
In doing it.
And so I just did it. And so I got in the van. We drove down a few blocks. We turned onto the street. Miss Bernice said, this is the house. Of course, Miss Bernice is, you know, she was an older woman. She's probably at that point, she was probably about 78, 79. You know, she had nothing to lose, I guess, at that point. And she knocked on the door.
Now, before we get to her answering the door and you actually meeting your grandfather,
mm-hmm.
to go to meet your mother. Talk a little bit about how you envisioned Evelyn and what your ideal was of her, that when you did finally meet her, how you idolized her in your mind.
Well, yeah, I think as a young girl, when I had that experience, if you've been listening to my story or read my book, you know that I found out I was not, you know, my foster mother's biological child. And so from there on, I just took on an image of who my mother was. And I remember seeing, you know, Tina Turner on the TV one day doing a performance on America Bandstand. And her name was Tina Turner. So I could identify Turner with me because my last name was Turner. And so from that moment, I just had this thing that, like, that could be my mom. Her name is Tina Turner. My mom could be famous. And so I just lived in this imaginary way of who my mother could be. I just really fixated on that as a child, that Tina Turner could be my mother. It was just this fantasy I grew into, and I just believed. And so, yeah, it just was something that I think it just kept me wishing or hoping that there was someone out there wanting me but couldn't find me.
There were circumstances beyond your control.
And she was probably singing in New York and on the America Bandstand and, you know, just couldn't find that space and time to come get me.
It was almost like the truth was harder to absorb, or maybe absorb isn't the right word, but the truth was more painful than the reality that you made, the fantasy that you made.
Yeah, of course. You know, I believe that is, and I keep saying that with everything I do with Laquita Speaks Truth and pain. Pain is another drug. And so, of course, it was, you know, that was a drug that I suffered with, was pain. And so to think that someone didn't want me was more painful than to imagine that someone just couldn't find the time to come get me.
Yeah. So you're with Miss Bernice, you're on the street to meet your grandfather for the first time ever. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm sitting, we pull up, I'm sitting in the van, and I look at the house, and I'm like, oh my God, surely God, if Tina Turner is my mom, she wouldn't let her dad live like this. Surely to God.
Right.
I mean, of course, so that reality began to be shaken. Like, Tina Turner is probably not my mom.
Or someone like Tina Turner.
Or somebody like Tina Turner.
Well, right.
Is not my mom.
Yeah.
Because why would she let her dad live in such conditions? You know, it was more of a poverty-stricken neighborhood and ran down. And so Miss Bernice, I cut the car off. Miss Bernice got out and she opened the gate. It was like a little gate, you know, and she walked up. And by the time I got out of my side and walked around to where she was already at the door knocking. Mm-hmm. And this frail little man, African-American male, bald-headed, came to the door. And Miss Bernice was like, hey, my name is Bernice. I used to work with your daughter, Evelyn. And I was just wondering, do you know where she is? Is she still in the city? I haven't seen her for a couple of years. The last time I seen her, she was here for her sister's funeral because her sister had died of cancer. And she said, so I haven't really seen her, but I was wondering if she's still here. And he's like, yeah, she lives right across the street. So I'm standing in the back of her. And she says, oh, she just lives across the street? And he said, yeah, she lives over there in my other house. So he owned the house he was in, and he owned the house that was across the street. And she said, it was just so amazing. Miss Bernie said, well, because I got somebody I want her to meet. This is your granddaughter. And he's like, okay, but Evan lives across the street.
So he didn't make the connection right away, or didn't know about you?
He didn't. I don't think he made the connection, nor did he care. You know what I mean? It's just like he looked like he was probably about maybe 90 years old. He just didn't, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
At that point, Evelyn lives across the street. That's what you came for. This is the information you're getting. I don't know if she's home, but she lives across the street. And he kept saying that.
Hmm.
And so Miss Marnie's like, okay, then I'll just go over here. And so that's when I knew, like, you know, I was like, I felt like I was about 8 steps away from a reality that I didn't know whether or not I was really ready for. And as I was turning around to go out the gate and passing the van, there was something just so much stronger in me saying, get back in that van and run. Then there was something deeper in me saying, fear not, I'm with you. Keep going. Keep going. And
which was like the same voice you heard in prison.
Yeah. It was just a real strong impression. Wasn't very pushy, but it was just, I could hear it. It sounded like me, but it was saying things to me that I would never say to myself. Because again, I'm a control freak. And if I'm not in charge, nobody's in charge. Because being in control was the way I protected me. It was how I survived. It was how, you know, it became my friend. Protecting how I operated was how I survived the life that I had. So it was like a moment that I had no control over. I keep saying it, and I will keep saying it, that this was beyond me. And so as we began to walk across the street, there was still 8 steps, like it was cement steps that you had to walk up to her door. And there was about 8 of them. And as Miss Bernice again plowed through the moment, and she knocked on the door, nobody came, and she knocked on the door again, and nobody came. And she's like, she might not even be home. And she said, I'm gonna knock one more time, and she knocked again. And I guess my mother was probably proceeding to the door, because by the time she got ready to knock the 3rd time, Evelyn was standing there. And she was just kind of saying, hello. And Miss Bernice was like, hey, Evelyn, don't you remember me? And my mother was kind of like, she was like, kind of like, I would describe it in a moment, like, not really, but being cordial, like, no, not really. Should I know you? And she was kind of making some words. I couldn't really understand it because I was standing in. I probably was standing on the 4th step by that time.
Not all the way up.
Well, I was not all the way up. But I could kind of hear the conversation. And so my mother was not a very, like me, very boisterous. She was very soft-spoken. A little woman, if she weighed 90 pounds soaking wet. You know, and so Miss Bernice kept explaining to her who she was. And she's like, we used to work at the dry cleaners together, me, you, Mary Ellen. And she, you know, she's like, we used to go out on weekends. And then finally it sounds like my mother kind of started coming to it. And she was like, oh, okay, yeah. She said, and I saw you a couple of years ago. You told me your sister died of cancer. And then my mother was like, oh, okay, yeah, how you doing? She said, I'm good. She said, I got somebody I want you to meet. And so by that time, Miss Bernice turned around and looked at me. She said, come on up. And so I came up the steps a little more, and she said, you know who this is? And my mother's like, no, is it your daughter? She's like, no, she your daughter. And my mother's like, no, I don't have no other daughter. My daughter's name is Dolly. She said, no, this is the daughter Mary Helen had. This is your daughter. And my mother looked at me, and she then asked, my brother, I had a brother's name is Philip. And Philip was like sitting on this porch area. It's like you walk up the steps and then there's a porch. And he was sitting there. And so he just was kind of like, what is going on here? And so then she said, well, y'all just come in. You know, my mother invited us in. When she invited us in, I just kind of looked around, because I'm that kind of person. I noticed what's out of place versus what's in place. And so I'm just very observative. And so I'm watching, I'm looking, I'm like, wow, this is my mother. This is not the person I envisioned. Like, it was just like my heart just dropped. Like, it wasn't like excitement or whatever. It was like a disappointment. She in turn said, well, what's your name? And I said, my name is Lucretia. And she said, no, I have a daughter that Mary Helen had, but her name ain't Lucretia. Her name is Lucreta.
Because you'd been called Lucretia your entire life. Yeah.
And she said, when was you born? And I said, 9/12/1960. She said, and what does it say on your birth certificate? I said, it says my mother's name is Evelyn Weaver. And she said, hold on. And she went in the back and she bought out a birth certificate. And it was the same birth certificate I had. And she looked at me and she said, wow, where have you been? I was like, you just said that I was with Mary Helen. I've been with Mary Helen. What do you mean, where have I been? I lived in Ohio with Mary Helen ever since you dropped me off that day and didn't come back and get me. And she's like, I didn't drop you off. She kidnapped you. And I said, if she kidnapped me according to the law, and she committed a crime, and why wouldn't you have sent the police to get me? Well, it's a long story. It don't matter now. And that's kind of like how she took it. And I was like, it does matter. I said, but I really don't want you to talk about my foster mom like that. Because she's not here to defend anything you're saying. And I really don't want you saying that about her. And she said, but your name is not Lucretia. I named you Lucreta. And I was like, okay. And what does that mean? And she said, you're my daughter. And so my brother Philip is there. And I could tell he's on drugs and he's having this moment. And he's like, oh my God, this is like a Jerry Springer. Where's she been? You know, and he was just having this big one. She kept telling him to shut up. And, you know, and he's like, no, that's my sister. Why wouldn't you have told us about her? You know, how old are you? And I told him I was 36. He's like, and you 36? Okay, I'm 40. He said, you 36, I'm 40. So I'm only like 4 years older than you. He's like, where you been at? And I said, I've been in Hamilton, Ohio, with my mom that raised me. And he's like, oh, man, that's crazy. He said, Mom, you had another daughter and didn't even tell us about it. And he went on and on. It just became this big old circle moment. And I kept saying, yeah, you know, okay, y'all, okay, whatever, whatever, whatever. And so in that moment, though, I'm going to be honest, it was like an out-of-body experience. I can't really say that I was present. I was, but I wasn't, if that makes sense. It just felt like, again, another trauma, another moment, another inflicted wound that I had to immediately adjust to and face.
Yeah, you just got through the moment and didn't let yourself really feel the gravity of what was happening.
Exactly.
Because Evelyn was... While she acknowledged you, it took a little while for her, like almost to coax her, to get to the point where she admitted that you existed.
Mm-hmm.
And then once she said, okay, there was a kind of a disconnect.
Yes.
And you talk about that in your book, how she, while she admitted that you were her daughter, it wasn't like an excitement
exactly.
over the fact that she had found you. So I can't imagine how
it
that pierced you.
It wasn't ever. It wasn't ever. You know, it wasn't ever an excitement like, you know, like a mother who finds her daughter. You see on the movies and all that, and then they hug and they embrace. She didn't even hug me. And it was so, you know, at that moment, it was like, so I said to her, you know, okay, I have, you know, a son. We're here in Louisville. And I explained to her why I was there and where we were and what we were doing. And at that point, I was staying with my dad. And I told her that. I said, I've been knowing my dad since I was 22. And his name is Earl. You know, she said, what's your dad's name? And I said, his name is Earl. She's like, okay. She said, you talking about Earl Turner? I said, yeah, Earl Turner. And she's like, oh, okay. I said, so I've been knowing him. I met him when I was 22. And she was like, wow. She said, and then she said, so you're here... For what? And I said, I'm here for a family reunion. We're at the park on 34th Street. And, you know, I said, would you like to go and meet my son and my rest of my family? And she's like, well, let me grab something and put it on. And she got in the van with me and Miss Bernice, and we went to the park.
Wow. That had to have been very surreal.
It
here
was.
You are in a car with your birth mother and a woman you just met that was very close with your foster mother.
And my biological mom. Miss Bernice was close with both of them. She worked with both of them.
But in that moment of being with them, going to a family reunion from your foster family, the thoughts that must have been going through your head, or maybe you were kind of blank because you couldn't process it all, but that had to be a very overwhelming
moment. It was very overwhelming. It was. It was. I mean, it was and it wasn't. It was because at that point I realized I'm back in control.
In that moment,
it's like, I'm back in control now. I'm deciding how this is going to, I'm navigating now, not Miss Bernice. So it's almost like I went from, as I said, in this moment of in or out of body experience to once I invited her, you notice I took the role. I took the lead. I told her, and then I said, would you like to go and meet my son and meet my husband, meet my family? I kind of felt like something shifted in that moment, and I became the leader. I became the one navigating the situation, if that makes sense. And maybe that was the way I preserved my emotions, the way I did self-preservation, what I had kind of navigated through all my pain was to take charge, to make it work, and to make it feel the way I needed it to feel. And so when we got back to the reunion, to the park, my mom sat there. I introduced her to everyone. They was, Southern people, just, no biggie, ain't asking a whole lot of questions. Right. And so the next day, I did take her home. We took her home, back home. And then the next day I asked her, could I come over? And so my son and myself and my husband went over, just the three of us. And I just will never forget. I looked at her, and she looked at my son, and she looked at me, and she said, I hope that we can get to know each other. That's what she said to me. And I said, what does that mean? She said, well, I don't drive and I don't really travel, but maybe sometimes you could come up and see me.
What did that invoke in you when she said that?
I said to her, I'll consider it. And so that was August the 3rd, 1997. My birthday was September the 12th. She asked me for my address that day. I gave her my address, and I got a letter from her that I still have today. And in it was $20, and she was just saying, "Babe," she used to call me baby girl, and that's what she called me. She said, "Lakrita, hey, baby girl, Lakrita, and this is your mom. And I just wanted to let you know that I was thinking about you. And I know today is your birthday. And I don't have much. Here's $20 for you to buy yourself something." And I still have that $20 in my God's jar. And she said, "I hope that you will consider to come see me sometimes." And so from that moment on, I felt like she was doing the best she could with what she had. And so it was now my job to do the best I could. And so I began to pursue that relationship. I would go up there once every month or once every other month and see her. And I met Dolly. I met my brother Charles. Philip, was just as crazy as a bed bug is the day long. And, but I met everyone. Dolly cooked dinner. We went to her house, and it still was surreal. I didn't know these people, but they were my family. So I got a chance to get over these 3 years because she passed away in 2000. So I had 3 years to get to know information about my medical history, about who I was and where I come from and who, just things like that. By the time I met my biological mom, she had had three heart attacks and had two bypass surgeries. And like I said, she weighed 90 pounds. She was also biracial. My mom was biracial. I don't know if people know that. Her mom was white and her father is African-American. And so Yeah, just getting to know all that and seeing pictures of my grandmother, who's a Caucasian woman, and kind of getting to know my grandfather. You know what I'm saying? He did pass probably about 4 or 5 months after that. And I went to his funeral, and he was a pastor and had been a pastor for like 50 years, and then he had retired. And I just kind of found out that my mom didn't raise any of her children, that it wasn't just me.
She walked away from all of her children.
Yeah, that my grandfather and his wife raised the other three primarily. Just those kind of things. And so, you know, one of the things that really happened too in this moment was that, I got the revelation that I was going to get a new name, right, and a new identity, but I didn't connect it the whole 3 years that I pursued because, see, I need people to know, I don't care how healed you think you are, there's always that little girl in you that still needs to be validated. And after she wrote me the letter and sent me the $20, that little girl was awakened again. And that's who, it wasn't a 37-year-old woman that was pursuing this woman. It was still that broken little girl that wished her mother had rescued her and came after her and made her life different. It wasn't my 37-year-old knowledgeable self. I was still seeking to be noticed, to say I meant something, to say I was valuable, to say that I mattered, to say that you loved me and that you did this because of love. I was still seeking, and I got none of that.
Yeah,
I got none of it. And so as the 3 years passed, on the 25th day of September, I got a phone call in 2000 that she was sick and probably wouldn't make it. Mm. And on the 26th day of September of 2000, she passed away. And I go to the funeral and I get there and I'll never forget this moment. And I go to that coffin and I see that body. And I finally say, this is over. She'll never be able to give me what I believe I wanted.
She can never make it right.
She'll never make it right.
Yeah.
And
so that makes your grief incredibly complex. The
yes.
loss.
Yeah.
You're not just losing someone you love. You're losing the possibility
of what could be or whatever was or will the truth ever be. Will I ever know the truth? Will I ever understand it? Will it ever make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
And so in that moment that I was having in that moment, and I walked back to I had the obituary in my hand, but I hadn't read it. My husband was sitting there, and he leaned over, and he said, I just want to say to you, don't be mad, but your name is not even in this obituary. Mm-hmm. I was like, what? He's like, your name ain't even mentioned. So by this time, I knew Dolly. So I went up to her and I said, what happened to my name? And she said, oh, I'm just letting you know. It had nothing to do with Mama's funeral. Everything she had already prepaid for. She had already told the people what she wanted. I said, what did you just say to me? She's like, yeah, Mama had did this like 10 years ago. That she had put this together. All I did was carry out what she wanted. I said, so you're telling me that she did this 10 years ago. So what you're telling me is that after me, she knew I existed, but never was going to acknowledge me. I said, but you knew I existed, Dolly. I just did what Mama asked me to do. That ain't got nothing to do with me. And I remember sitting in that chair in that moment. And this is when it all came. And I hadn't heard the voice the whole 3 years that I was pursuing this relationship. And I'm sitting in that chair and I could hear this voice say to me. And they were little voices and then there were big voices. And it was almost like the gremlins. If anybody have ever seen those movies, it was like these little gremlins that was standing. They was like little people standing by my feet wanting me to pick them up to say, nurture me, Nurture me rejection. Nurture me abandonment. Mm. Nurture me loss of identity. Come on, pick me back up. Because you got to realize 5 years, I have worked through some counseling and dealt with some things, but I could feel these things saying, come on, pick me back up. And then I heard this stronger voice say, it don't matter that she did not identify you. I identify you. Who do I say you are? And I just remember that day. I could hear the voice of the Lord say to me, who do I say that you are? You are a daughter of the King. You are my daughter. You went and after something I never sent you to get. I sent you to get your new name. Because she was the only one that could give it to you. And you went after something for 3 years that was still empty in you. Because you don't believe you are who I say you are.
You were looking for Evelyn to fill up that part of you exactly. That only God could fill up.
He said, so you can either pick up these little moments again, or you can tell me right now, who do I say you are? And in that moment, I sat there and I wept and cried. And I'm sure people at the funeral was thinking I was crying because of her. But I was having a moment with God that only he could have healed. And I said, I am a daughter of the King. I am who you say I am. I am now a new creation. I am who you have always said that you knew me before the foundations of this world. You knew my name. When I made my bed in hell, you was there, as it says in Psalm 139. Before the foundations of the world that was laid, as it says in Ephesians, I was there and you was there. Before I was in my mother's womb, you knew me, as it says in Jeremiah 1:4. Yeah, that's who I am. This hurts like hell, Lord. But I know you'll heal me if I let you. And so I went back into counseling after that for another year. To really deal with that wound. And that's when the Lord showed me, your name is Lucreta. She's never been in prison. She never stole. She never was abused. She was never a homosexual. She never lived in promiscuous. She never, you know, did these things. Not Lucreta. Lucretia did that. So let's let go of Lucretia. Let's get introduced to Lucreta, who I say you are. And your mother, Evelyn, was never meant to be your mother. I gave you to Mary Ellen as a gift, and you could not receive it because you believed that your way was better than mine. So it was another healing, another moment, another time. And so, in that year, I went through that pain and I embraced again how I want to control stuff. He said, not once did you ask me. And I didn't. When all this happened and I told you I took the wheel, not once in them 3 years did I ask him, why am I here?
You just pointed to something and said, she will make me complete.
I didn't even point to it. I just took back the characteristics in which I was used to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Running my life. Most of us do that, whether we believe it or not. We like to run our lives.
Mm-hmm. We like to tell God how it should be.
Should be.
Yeah.
If we be honest.
Yeah.
We like to tell him how he should have done it.
Yeah.
And so we begin to write the story we believe best fits the narrative.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. That day at that funeral, he showed me again, I am God and God alone, not you. But I had to go in some more counseling to deal with that.
You know what I find that's important to point out, especially for people who might be listening to this and they're getting into a new place of another cycle of healing,
mm-hmm.
that your prior healing that you had encountered was still valid and still there. It's just this new part was
it's like layers. Healing is layer. I'm 28 years in it. I'm in counseling right now. So, yeah, it's like a car. You take it to get oil changes every 3,000 to 5,000 miles. You take it to get a tune-up. Some of us take better care of our cars and houses than we take care of ourselves. And so I just say yes. Every time a level of something you don't know how to navigate, what I've learned now and learning is that I have to ask God, why am I here?
Right.
What are you trying to teach me? What am I to get out of this?
Right.
And can you drive this and not me? It takes all of those moments and it will continue. It says line up on line, precept on precept, here a little, there a little. That's what the Bible says. That means, in other words, we wake up gradually. We learn piece by piece. We gather information about who we're not just as well as who we are. And we get to a point in our walk and our journey after we've hit our heads multiple times and we keep hitting it and the pain gets greater. It's usually two things that usually bring you to your knees. Suffering and pain brings you to your knees greater than anything. But God is teaching me that let joy bring you to your knees, Lucretia. Let the moment that you're in bring you to your knees. Even if it's an experience you never had. Not the greatest piece of my life, humanity. And I'm in a new season of learning how to validate them with truth and empathy. But that's not something I am mostly great at. I'm great at making things happen. That is, you know, naturally I'm in the disc, I'm a DI, and you know, in the Enneagram, I'm an 8. Again, the number 8. You know, I'm an 8. You know, I'm that, you know, NF, I think I'm an ENJ something, you know, in different things. That means I'm strong, dominant, you know, alpha person. I'm an alpha girl. I'm an alpha woman. That's who I am. I get it done. I know how to get it done. I think about it. But what I'm learning is that the vulnerability of my life right now is that I've went to God in the last 4 years to say to him, I don't know how to operate well in an emotional way with your people. I know how to get the job done, but I don't know how to connect. So I need you to teach me. And so I've been in this classroom where he is teaching me to be smart, meaning emotionally intelligent with people. He's teaching me to feel the grief of loss and the understanding of joy and the disappointments and the letting goes and the people don't just wake up to hurt you, Lucretia. They're preserving themselves and you don't have to be so defensive and you don't have to be right. You can win. There can be a win-win. There can be a compromise. That doesn't make you weak. But I had to learn and I'm learning these things at 59. Because the thing about this life, you get opportunities. You can stay the way you are, or you can choose to grow and become some that you always was meant to be. And just because I was delayed, I wasn't denied. See, I was delayed in my development because of my pain. But God didn't deny me of my development. I had to choose it. And say, I want it. I want to do and be the best version of the me you created. From all my pain and all my experiences, all my lost identities, all these things that I thought I was and I wasn't, I want to know the freedom of me. Who am I? And only you, you haven't changed your mind from the day you came and encountered me in prison when you said you will never have definition of meaning till you come back to the source, He didn't change his mind then. And 28 years later, he still ain't changed his mind.
You've been listening to the Embracing Change podcast. Music production and mastering by Gone Coastal Productions. Podcast editing and production by Jennifer Osborne. Podcast copyright 2020 by Lakrita Bowman.